All right, so we have to do some very natural pre-show banter. That isn't something interesting enough to put in the show.
That's right, and seems natural and not forced.
Yeah. There we go.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sneaky Dragon. My name is David Dedrick.
Oh, are we still doing this show?
We are still doing the show.
What episode is
it? Here's the thing.
Well, no, what episode is this?
Here's the thing. You do not stop doing a show at episode 223.
220, that's too long.
That is...
No one's been listening this long. This is ridiculous. I got to get back to work. I'm sorry. No, if you want to do the show yourself,
please do it.
I'm Ian Boothby, by the way. If you want to keep doing the show, go ahead. I'll help as much as I can. But I just got some stuff to do. Mm-hmm. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to do stuff around the office today while you do the show.
So you're don't do any vacuuming. That's my only request. Although it is a constant noise, so I can probably take it out with noise removal. So vacuum away, actually.
Okay.
Vacuum away.
And we're recording this on March 10th. So happy Mario Day.
Why is that March?
Because M-A-R and then 10 spells Mario.
But it's a celebration of Mario. It's Marchio.
It's not Marchio because there's no CH. It's M-A-R. That's the shortened version.
Yeah.
And then 1 and 0 looks like Mario.
Okay. Seems
so like... we celebrate the birth of our savior, Super Mario, who saved us from a giant dragon that steals our somewhat platonic girlfriends.
Is Mario...
It takes us through the many lands.
Wait. Is Mario not the sort of the protagonist in Donkey Kong?
No, actually, he is not. The character there is a character that looks like Mario. The people say he's Mario.
I say he's Mario.
That's fair enough. But
I say he's Marchio.
But his original name was Jumpman.
Hmm.
Over time, he later became Mario. But the original name was Mario. And the theory,
Jumpman.
Yeah, it was, but Jumpman. You're right. The Mario we know today, according to legend. Nintendo legend is the son of that Jumpman.
Oh.
Now because Mario's name, full name, is Mario, you can call that other guy Mario.
Yeah.
But that's his last name.
That's
now,
last
the first name,
name
Mario, Jump, guy, Jump. The guy we're on first name basis,
sure.
When you go Mario and Luigi, Luigi's last name is Mario as well. So it's Luigi, Mario, and Mario.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And Jumpman Mario.
Jumpman Mario.
Okay.
Right. So that's not Mario.
It is,
but though. But it's his surname is Mario. But you don't call him by his surname because, what is it, the 90s? Oh, I guess it was the 90s and the 80s. Oh, shit. Yeah, maybe you would because that's what people did back then. Anyway.
Is it what people did back then?
Yeah. And the reason that we know that Donkey Kong is different than the Donkey Kong of present day, who is the peer of Mario, is because the present Donkey Kong wears a tie.
I was going to say a bow tie.
Not a bow tie.
This is a dumb joke.
No. As a long tie. He wears a proper long tie with a D and a K on it.
Is there a collar as well? Like, does he have one of those sort of collars that Yogi Bear would wear?
That is a good question. I don't remember. I think he just wears the tie. I think just because he goes to a lot of formal restaurants, and they just require it. They don't mind the no shirt and no shoes, but they do require a tie for an ape.
They'll provide him with a jacket.
Right. And he's more of a good guy now. He does not kidnap as the previous Donkey Kong, who later became Cranky Kong. That's his name now. He's old.
Because he's grumpy?
He's grumpy. He's cranky. He talks about the old days when there was only 8-bits. You'll find that in your Donkey Kong Country games, that character.
Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, that's been our Mario talk. So thank you for celebrating Mario Day with us, everybody.
Yes, thank you.
I know a lot of you have been saying, you know, we should talk about various other subjects. Absolutely no one has been saying we should talk about Mario more.
That hasn't come up. You're right. No one wants to hear more
about it. But you know what it did? Killed 4 minutes.
You did it.
Boom.
You did it.
That's right. This is killing time. Time you'll never get back. How many episodes of the show have you listened to? Not going to get that time back.
But
that's our guarantee.
I always hope that our listeners are multitasking.
Mm.
That they're not just sitting in a chair.
That's what I'm doing right now. I'm just doing some cleaning around the
office.
I
know you're cleaning up.
I'm feeding my lizard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're remarkably audible.
Handsome.
Sure, yes, you are, but also audible. for someone who's walking around cleaning a room.
Oh, that's because I have the theater training.
You have
to project
training.
My voice. Now, Dave, look, I'm right up close to the microphone. Mm-hmm. Now I'm walking to the back of the room right now.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now you can't even tell, right?
You can't.
This is me projecting my voice. I'm gonna walk a little closer back to the microphone. And this is my talking directly into the microphone. Very similar. Because I can project my voice.
I would say exactly similar.
It's really stressing the diphthongs.
Is it? What about the labiodental fricatives?
Please, I'm married. How you been?
That's all I remember from my class in, what's it called? Linguistics.
Nice.
And the schwa.
Did you ever learn about intercostal diaphragmatic breathing?
Did not.
Okay. It's basically belly breathing. It's the way you project, can get your voice across an auditorium.
I also learned about the schwa.
Okay, explain the schwa.
I don't know what it is, though. Because I hated that class.
I'm familiar with Schwab's, which used to be a drugstore.
That's
think?
Right. This is the
Schwinn, which was a type of bike.
This is the
and Schweppes, which is a type of club soda and ginger ale.
This is the father of Schwab's. This is Schwa.
Schwab.
Of course, as we know, it was Schwab.
Yeah.
His brother Luigi Schwab.
Yep.
And okay. Anyway, Jumpman Schwa.
Is Wario related in any way to Mario, or do they just have similar names and looks?
Are you talking about Wario?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know who you're talking about.
You just said, are you talking about Wario? Why did you clarify if you didn't know who I was talking about?
No. Did I say that?
Just now, yeah.
I'll listen back to the tape later and see if I said that.
Okay.
I don't know if I said Wario.
Yeah, just wondering if Wario and Waluigi are in some way related, like cousins or something to...
Don't they look exactly the same? Only one has a kind of a lightning bolt mustache?
Pretty much, yeah.
Am I right? Is that right?
Yeah. You know a lot know? About them. What That's are you talking
weird
about?
That I didn't, because I don't really... I guess I know that.
Yeah, I know that Wario is supposed to be the evil version of Mario,
okay.
Generally. But he's not evil, really. He's just greedy.
He's a twin.
He's kind of like a Scrooge McDuck type.
He's Wario Mario.
Except he punches more people than Scrooge McDuck, who probably would punch people, except he's an old man and has got feather hands.
He has a cane.
Yeah. By the way, they're bringing that back. DuckTales is being brought back.
Mm.
So, there.
It's about time, I
Is
guess.
It? Is know. It? Yeah. There's way more stories to tell.
Were we missing that show particularly?
Some people like DuckTales.
Now, that was the one it was an Australian mouse with a ginger mustache. Is
wow.
that correct?
I don't think so at all. Nope.
There's a female pilot.
Nope.
Mouse character.
Not at all. Nope. You were thinking of...
Tailspin.
I think you're thinking of Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers.
Oh, Rescue Rangers. That's where I'm getting mixed up. DuckTales was a completely different song.
Right. Now, Tailspin was a weird one because it had the characters from Jungle Book. But like Shere Khan... who's a tiger, was an industrialist.
Mm-hmm.
That's not right, right? You don't take Rudyard Kipling's characters and make Baloo is now a pilot. What's that about? Mowgli?
Yeah.
Like, what's this about? And not even the main character, like all the side characters in a Rudyard Kipling book. That's strange.
Yeah.
That's like you know, doing a thing about like a cruise line, but it's all Alice in Wonderland characters, but Alice doesn't show up.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, the Mad Hatter is the captain and shit. And it's like, well, what's that about? But they did that with your Tailspin.
It
and
was
people,
weird.
People seem to enjoy it.
It was weird. Rikki Tikki Tavi was a street person with Tourette's. It's very odd.
Mm-hmm.
Very odd. Couldn't stop saying his name.
Oh, that's really sad. What a completely sad story.
Glad I told it.
Now,
speaking of sad,
go ahead. Yeah, well, I think we're probably going to bring up the same
thing. Sure. Okay, you bring it up first.
Which is so quite a few people have like contacted us and asked because there was a George Martin passed away this week and said, "Will you do another episode of Completely Beatles talking about him?" And to my mind, I think we covered George Martin's contribution to the Beatles in the episodes that we did.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect that you have some thoughts on his passing and wanted to throw the floor over to you. There's some floor to you.
Really? I feel like we said everything we ever wanted to say about George Martin. I mean, it is sad that he's passed. Mm-hmm. But then again, he was 90 years old. So I feel like that's a pretty good inning. I'd be quite happy. I wouldn't be happy to die, obviously, but that seems like fair.
And would you?
A fair age.
And, okay.
I mean, he hasn't been doing that much for the last several years because he had the problem that a lot of people who work in sound get, which is a producer's ear or engineer's ear, which mm-hmm. is tinnitus or hearing loss, very common. And so he could not hear anymore. Even when he was doing the even when he was supervising
the Cirque du Soleil show.
I don't think he had much to do with Cirque du Soleil. His son.
Yeah, he did the real the love show that.
It was his son Giles who did the actual mix.
Okay, well, according to the documentary, they played it up that he had a bigger part to do with finding certain takes and finding certain.
Well, he may
cuts.
Have remembered those sort of things.
Yeah, and so he found them, and then but I think you're right. The hearing loss did definitely play into it.
Yeah, and same when he was involved with supervising the new releases in stereo, the new stereo mixes and the mono remasters and stuff like that. But once again, it was his son Giles who did the majority of the work, you know. I mean, I don't know what else we can say about George Martin. I mean, I really admire him. I think, you know, and I feel like I was saying to someone the other day, I just mentioned Dick Rowe, the famous head of Decca who turned down the Beatles. And of course, everyone mocks him now for that. But I always feel like that was like the greatest thing, one of the greatest things that happened to the Beatles was the fact that they didn't get picked up by Decca, missed being just one band of many on a label that was unsympathetic to rock and roll, really, and would have just sort of cookie-cuttered them into every other act if they could, you know.
Right.
Whereas being signed to a smaller label like Parlophone, where the head of the label was their producer, you know, and gave them a real... and was really sympathetic person. I mean, yes, he started off with this idea that, you know, trying to figure out who was the better singer. Was it John or was it Paul? You know, one of them had to be the lead and one of them had to be the lead singer because that was the style
of the time,
right? Yeah, that was the way it worked. And, you know, and then he had a song that, you know, written, you know, just to, you know, a song that was just like made for to be a hit song of that time period. And, you know, he wanted them to sing it. And they duly practiced it and came back and did a version of it. But, you know, he was also flexible enough and sympathetic enough that, you know, he said, you know what, both of them are leads. We don't need to choose John or Paul to be the lead singer. Both of them can do it.
Now, did that change music in that way and allow other bands to do that? Or did they keep up kind of the idea that you have to have one lead singer?
You know what, if you think about the 60s, there wasn't really a lot of bands that had more than one lead singer. I mean, you had unusual bands like The Who, where Roger Daltrey did not write the songs. It was Pete Townsend who wrote the majority of the songs, and Roger wrote almost all the songs, except for on A Quick One While She's Away, which was this weird contractual album where, in order to sign this contract, Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp had agreed that all the Who would contribute songs. So John Entwistle, who did write many songs, he wrote some songs, but also Roger Daltrey wrote some songs and Keith Moon wrote some songs. And it's kind of interesting. They're not great songs. It's interesting. I mean, they're a great band, so they can kind of make it interesting. But and I think Pete Townsend probably had a little bit to do with editing what people did as well. But going back to the Beatles, and then the Beach Boys would be an example.
I was going to ask about the Beach Boys, yeah.
They're an example of a band, but when they started, I mean, Mike Love sang the majority of the songs. Brian Wilson sang the ballads, and Mike Love was the rock and roll voice. So if you had, like, In My Room or the song...
God Only Knows, or is that...
Well, that's later. That actually was Carl. I'm thinking of the song... Damn it, Surfer Girl. Mm-hmm. That's Brian again. So the kind of the slower ballads were Brian with his falsetto would do those songs, and then Mike Love would do the rock and roll ones. And yeah, later on, then Brian kind of started to parcel out the songs. So, you know, here you go, Al, you can sing Help Me Rhonda. And Carl, you can do God Only Knows. And Dennis, you can do Dance, Dance, Dance. And so everyone kind of got their little bit of the feature. And when they played live, they would have their feature parts of the show as well, because the girls could shriek over Dennis, you know, and if he's always hidden behind the drums, then it really isn't, you're not really, you know, putting your real assets to the fore, you know, because Mike Love was a pretty good singer, but not a great looking guy, let's face it. I mean, compared to Dennis, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want him hidden behind the drums the whole time. And then, if you think about it, let me think. So then the Kinks, Dave Davies did sing some songs, but Ray Davies, you know, who wrote most of the songs, sang most of the songs, and Dave Davies kind of got a feature part. And I can't remember the other song. I mean, Mick Jagger sang almost all the songs for the Rolling Stones. Occasionally, Keith Richards would get a little bit in it, and Bill Wyman wrote a couple of songs. that he had his B-sides mostly. I just don't really kind of think of too many bands where you did have that kind of switch off.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that George Martin got... it wasn't one of those situations where he never got the credit he deserved. Like, he actually... People knew who he was during the, you know, like... The late 60s, the 70s, you know, like, because I've heard of him. He's always been referred to as the fifth Beatle. Do you think that he was satisfied with his place in music?
Is it
a happy story? I'm saying the George Martin story.
Yes, is it a happy story. He originally, when he signed the Beatles, he was the head of Parlophone. Mm-hmm. He'd been the head for several years before the Beatles came along. And the original head of Parlophone, when it was purchased by EMI, was a guy named Oscar Preuss, who pretty much handpicked George to be his successor at the label. And George took over, and he kind of took it in an interesting direction. He did a lot of comedy albums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did the first Beyond the Fringe album. He did Flanders and Swan. He did Peter Sellers albums. He did Goon Show.
Yeah, people
record.
Have been posting a lot of those up lately because of his passing. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's interesting.
Well, what's interesting, like the Goon Show one is interesting because not only it wasn't really a Goon Show one, it featured Spike Milligan, but also had like Peter Cook on it and people that weren't like actual goons. And then it was a parody of Bridge on the River Kwai, and they called it Bridge on the River Kwai, and then they got a letter threatening them with some sort of suit. So George had to go through and cut all the K's out of that word. So it became Bridge on the River Y, W-Y-E. And so, yeah, just one of those interesting things of like, why would you having to edit? I mean, why not just, that makes me think of, there's a Bob Dylan record, John Wesley Harding. And apparently the whole album, when he was recording it, his buttons on his sleeves were hitting the guitar. And so you could hear like all this rattling and stuff of that as he's playing his guitar. So then they had to go through. The producer, Bob Johnson, had to go back and edit out all this rattling of buttons.
Taking out all the buttons.
Yeah. But why not just say, hey, Bob, roll up your shirt. we're getting a lot of button noise. Well, save yourself some work, Bob. But anyway, so yeah. But I think I'm of two minds. Like I always feel like as people get older, they feel like they're unsure of their legacy, you know, and they want to make sure that everyone knows. So you've had a lot of Paul McCartney, for instance, you know, making sure that we know what he did in the Beatles and that because it's hard for him, you know, John Lennon died
mm-hmm.
and now he's a saint, you know, everyone wants to sing Imagine and he's such a great guy and, you know, everyone loves John Lennon. So the peace guy, he's all about peace and, you know, and then poor Paul, he's still hanging around. And everyone's like, oh, well, that guy's still around. He's just a jerk because he's not dead. It's easy to be a great guy when you're dead. It's hard to be a great guy when you're alive and you marry some woman and it turns out badly after your wife dies and everyone's kind of sympathetic to him. Then he marries another woman and was like, oh, he married kind of fast after his wife died. You know, and all this kind of stuff like that, right?
Yeah,
like, it's
and,
hard.
You know, listen, Paul died first, too. He did it before it was cool.
He did it before it's cool. And now.
And you know what?
Okay.
He came back.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Sure.
Good for him. Try and do that.
If you want to say that, then the actor who's still playing, portraying Paul
right.
is still alive and people, you know, and so it's a hard row to hoe, right? Being alive and being, you know, and having to like kind of sort of, you know, I did that too. It wasn't all John, but do it in a way that's respectful to John's memory and that you don't seem like a pushy jerk. It's hard. And I feel like George Martin also is the same. It's kind of like, you know, we want to give a lot of credit to the Beatles, a lot of credit to John and Paul, and they had all these great ideas and stuff like that. And George, at the same time, was kind of like, hey, I was there too. I mean, I was a producer, and I had ideas. And
yeah, from what you broke down during the Completely Beatles, yeah, he had a big part to play. Like, I look at, like, Paul McCartney, though, and I go, I mean, the guy has had, like, a hit song in every decade since,
sure.
too, you know, multiple
sure.
hit songs.
Yeah.
He's done very, very well, and he's done other material since,
yeah, yeah.
you know. So
oh, we know, but at the same time, there is
the
that
Beatles
element.
Is that sacred
yes,
time.
Yes, that's right.
That's it's something as you're right. It's preserved in amber. It's sainted. It's you know,
mm-hmm.
you can, whatever you do afterwards, no matter how popular, will not be.
It can't reach that. I mean, same with George Martin. I mean, he worked while the Beatles were you know while he was producing the Beatles, he produced other artists. He produced Cilla Black and Jerry and the Pacemakers and a lot of the Epstein, a lot of the NEMS. Artists like Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas and mm-hmm. stuff and the Foremost and things. And then, you know, he produced, when the Beatles broke up, you know, he produced America, he produced Jeff Beck, he produced Cheap Trick. you know, he did other things. And also, he, in the mid-60s, he quit his position at Parlophone and became an independent producer. And then he was able to charge more money. You know, he's only getting a salary as the producer of the Beatles for a long time. When he quit and became an independent producer, then he could get a percentage of their earnings for the record. He could get a producer's percentage. And then he started AIR Studios in London, which was, I think, standard for Associated Independent Recorders. And he had that studio there. And then he opened one on Montserrat, the island. He opened Air Studios there as well, which was a very for a long time a very popular studio.
Is that the one that's recently been destroyed? Not destroyed, but really messed up by a volcano.
It had already kind of fallen into disuse and
but decay, a volcano but, never helps.
And the volcano did not help. You're right. It was not an improvement. The lava flung through the front door was not an improvement. Melting the gold records on the walls. But I've heard that it was already in some disrepair. Mm-hmm. That it, you know, it had just kind of been allowed to its days were done.
That's too bad.
I think he did well. I think he did really well, and you know, and
I just mean that's the kind of space that, like, yeah, you could actually make a little bit touristy. You know, people would go to take a
sure
look at that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look back at albums that you know, I think lots of different. I think the Police recorded there, and I think like Dire Straits recorded. A lot of artists recorded there. It was a nice place to go, right? You go, yeah, you're in. You know, I don't know where Montserrat is. I've always assumed.
Do I, actually.
I always assumed it was the Caribbean.
Yeah,
but it could not be. It might be.
I just
else
picture, like, if you went there, everyone would be dressed like in Casablanca. A lot of people in white suits with fezes.
Yeah,
you know, just like, hello, Mr. Dedrick.
Yes. Yeah.
The laws don't apply here. Monkey knife fight. Enjoy. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. I don't really know.
I always find, like, you know, we've had a couple of recording studios in town, you know, kind of close up like Mushroom,
yeah,
and what have you. And I always thought, like, why not just make that into, like, a museum of some sort? Like
Because the real estate is so valuable. That's why it's closed down. It's not because...
No, I gotcha.
Okay.
I gotcha. But then, you know, when you're a museum, you get certain tax breaks and you get certain things.
Yeah, yeah.
And it all helps to... But here's the thing. If you have the museum there, right, yeah, now everything, yeah, around it, I would say, becomes, oh, you know, this is where people will come to, you know, check out where...
I don't think it would be that, but I mean, who recorded there that people want to go see? Hart? I mean, I know Hart recorded there.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to go out of the way to come see where Hart recorded Dreamboat Annie and where...
I think, maybe. I don't know. Hart's very popular.
Chilliwack recorded there.
Did Loverboy record there?
I guess so. They probably did.
They were very popular.
They were.
Yes.
They still... They can still pack
it. Listen,
in,
all
pack
museums deal with stuff in the past, brother.
I know it does, but I just feel like...
But what have the Aztecs done lately?
The landlord, yeah, the guy who owns the land,
yeah,
who just turned it into condominiums, I think he's doing a little better than the museum would be.
I wonder.
I like your altruistic attitude.
That's not altruistic. I just feel like I look at a city like Paris, which is not at all like us. But it's just when you buy into the culture of things that have happened in your location, it feels like that makes everything more valuable around instead of just like, well, how valuable is this building? It's as valuable as a building made of glass and fucking steel is. But what happened here? Oh, you know, all these albums that influence culture were made here. Oh, shit, that's amazing. And what's next door? This condo. Fuck, I would like to move into this condo that's right next to this thing that was an amazing thing. But we've smashed that thing down to build a condo on top of it. Well, fine.
Yeah, I mean,
Hart was recorded where I'm now taking a dump. You know, it's like, fine.
Dreamboat Annie.
Ship of dreams.
Flush. There's that ship of dreams.
Yeah.
Down the drain. Ship of poo. The thing is...
Tell me the thing, Dave.
A city like Paris...
Oui, oui.
Which, what you see of Paris, you see a small element of Paris, right?
Yeah.
You don't see all of Paris. We don't go out into the suburbs. I imagine...
I still think there's Parisians
there.
And
I could be wrong. I imagine those places aren't much to look at. They're not that great.
I bet if you looked in the
cupboard. They're getting plowed down and turned into condos and townhouses and packed together.
Not high ones, I think, because they still have like height limits.
No, not on the outskirts. That's where you see all the tall buildings out there.
Too bad. I bet they all have wine in their cupboards, though.
Oh, sure they do. A bunch of people here do, too. They probably have some built-in.
They got better wine.
It probably says when you look at
that. Much better wine.
When you look at the ad,
uh-huh,
when you go to buy the townhouse or condo or whatever you're buying, you look at it and it says has a wine cellar. Then you go look, it has a wine cellar and den. Then you go look, the wine cellar is just one of those little X things in a cupboard.
And that's just for the kids.
And the den The den is just...
Because the kids drink wine there is what I'm saying, Dave. The kids drink wine.
I'm talking about here.
Oh, here. Okay, go ahead. Kids don't drink wine here. Well, they do, but they shouldn't.
Why not?
Continue.
The kids can have Eucharist. It's allowed. Like, if you look at, like, a say, you look at a normal condo ad here, right? They'll say it has a den. You know what the den is? It's a desk in the wall.
Mm.
That counts as a den.
Okay.
So I'm pretty sure the wine cellar that they're also advertising is just one of those little X things.
Before we get back into the condo situation discussion, is there anything more on George?
I could talk about George all day long.
Okay, just because I want to get a clean cut on the George thing so I can put, like, maybe on our site. We talked about, you asked us to talk about this. We talked about from this to this.
Why?
And until we get into a rant on the Vancouver real estate market in the middle, and people are like, oh, I, what?
That's not what I came
Come
here
on.
For.
Yeah, that's right. Look, we had a deal podcast. No, I'm glad that he did the...
Completely realtors.
Yeah, it makes me kind of happy that he did the comedy stuff, though, because I feel like he probably had a good time doing those.
Oh,
I can't
I'm sure
see
he did.
How you wouldn't have had a really good laugh doing that, enjoying yourself. When did... Did he just stop doing that, do you think, because the comedy albums scene kind of died off?
I think he became too busy for that, and I think once... Mm. You know, I mean, that was... I mean, basically, he was trying to find something that would be hits.
Yeah.
That's what he was looking for, right? So when he was producing Humphrey Littleton and his trad jazz band doing Bad Penny Blues, he was thinking, well, trad jazz is popular. I will produce this and maybe it'll be a hit. And when he was producing Shane Fenton and the Fentones, he was thinking, well, the kids seem to be liking rock and roll. Okay. Maybe they'll like this.
By the way, anyone out there needs some back teen, go get some for those deep cuts.
Is that too deep?
Those are some deep cuts.
I don't know if I was right about
that. I can see bone, brother. Well, I always think, like, with the comedy albums, you know, and again, I do comedy albums, so I'm not one to judge, but I feel like those would be easier to do than, say, a music album, because you've got to, like, if from what you've told me about, like, with the Beatles, you know, and his work with them, you know, there's so many little tweaks and finding this and getting this angle, whereas with the comedy albums... You lay down the track. You try to cut it to be as funny as possible,
yeah,
as sharp as possible. But you know, and maybe there'd be some music in it. But it seems
and
like they'd
sound
be
sound effects and things too.
Yeah, but it feels like they'd be less difficult to do than a rock and roll album.
You say that, but look at the
I
Beatles.
I do say that, having put out a couple of not great CDs.
But look at the Beatles' first album, where it was just them recorded in a studio, in a, you know, what it was, an 11-hour day or whatever.
Right.
And that was their album. Done. Okay. Ready to go. You know, it was probably more difficult to put in all the layered sound effects and stuff like that for Peter Sellers' piece, where, you know, some of them were without. Obviously, some of them just had a plain. But he must have still been, I don't know if he's still producing them, but they're still doing, like, Peter Sellers. Remember he did, like, The Hard Day's Night as King Richard III and stuff like that? Those would have still been on Parlophone.
Yeah, some people have put those up again recently. That's why I know that. I guess one of my big regrets is that you didn't get a chance to interview him.
Because
I would like to, I would like to have heard an interview with you.
I probably would have bored him with a lot of questions.
No, that's what an interview is. I'm sure he's aware of what that would be.
He can ask you a lot of stuff.
And then you have to ask it loudly because he can't hear really good.
Yes. And he did interesting things too. Like I posted on our Completely Beatles Facebook page, I posted a single that he released under the AKA Ray Cathode. It was a single.
I get it.
Do you get it?
Yeah. Because cathode ray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it would go right over your head.
Nope.
You got it?
Yep. I'm trying to think, like, cathode ray going over me. Is that a reference to anything? Not that I can think of.
Just, I think someone was pulling a dick move.
Fair
but
enough.
But anyway, he produced this single in conjunction with some of the people at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And so it's kind of like the sort of early or proto-electronica, you know, using a lot of, like, what... I don't think they had synthesizers yet, but using tape edits and things like that, or oscillators or whatever they had to create different kind of sounds. You know, just like when they also created, like, the Doctor Who theme, the original Doctor Who theme.
Oh, really?
With
neat.
Okay. Using, you know, kind of theremin-style things.
And that is a really good theme. Let's all admit that much.
It's a great theme.
It's a great theme.
It's too bad it has been boulderized to nothing.
Fair enough. But you know what? I think there have been some seasons of the show where the theme was the best thing and just kept you watching. Or the hopes that, like, you know what? It's going to be the end soon and the theme's going to come on again. Everything's going to be all right.
And then, so we did this thing. It was called Time Beat. And with I can't remember something about Orbit, the B-side. But it's if you're interested in hearing it, it is on the Completely Beatles Facebook page for you to hear. And yeah, I mean, just, and that was actually done the same year as he signed the Beatles. So, I mean, he was looking for a rock and roll act. He knew that that was coming and that people were, this was going to be a thing. And so he should, you know, like there was Cliff Richards, there was the Shadows, you know, people were having success. And so he was looking for a band that would kind of meet that, you know. And so when Brian Epstein showed up at his doorstep, well, actually it was Dick James called him and said, hey, listen, there's a guy who's coming. You might be interested in this group. And he's heard it and said, not much. You know that, but he was looking, so he's like, well, it's not much, but I'll give them a chance. I'll have right. them come in. And I mean, what really sold him on the Beatles wasn't their music. He wasn't that impressed by their music. What sold him was their personalities. When he said, is there anything that you don't like? George Harrison said, well, your tie for a start. You know, and that broke the ice, and they, you know, started, and he realized, oh, these guys have a great sense of humor, and that made him attracted to them because he liked comedy. You know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, and so he started to, you know, work with them, and I guess, you know, there probably was a lot of cajoling of him to get him to agree to do Love Me Do rather than What You Do and things like that. But I think, you know, I know it's a controversy who was the fifth Beatle. I know a lot of people think it was Marie the K.
Okay.
No, not me. I know it well. It's kind of, it's either between Brian Epstein, mm-hmm. George Martin, and Neil Aspinall. Those are your choices, basically. The sensible ones, right? You've got Brian Epstein, who basically discovered them, helped them, paid them, coached them, you know, got them, cajoled them into a professional act and got them out there, you know, and absolutely gave 100% of his support to them, you know. No matter what they did, he was on their side, you know.
Now, I know that an ambulance went by. Sorry that I blew what went by. Those of you that are completely Beatles listeners and have never listened to this show before, we have a thing where we try to guess what ambulances, not ambulances, what
emergency vehicles.
We try to guess what ambulances are. And if you guess ambulance, you're usually right. You know what?
Forget it.
All we got to tell you is if you've got a drink nearby, take a drink when you hear a siren. It's a long week, folks. Back to Dave.
What was I talking about?
You were talking.
Oh yeah,
fifth Beatles.
So yeah,
and three fifths of a Beatles.
And of course, George Martin, obviously, this, you know, sympathetic ear, this guiding hand, this person who took their music and made it into something that they didn't even dream of. You know, it's been like yesterday where Paul wrote this song. The other Beatles said, you know what, you should do it on your own. You should just sing it. It's a big band arrangement is going to wreck it. So just you sing it with acoustic guitar, which he did. And then it was George Martin who said, you know what you should do is add some strings to it. And of course, Paul McCartney's reaction to that was not rock and roll. You know, we're not a fancy supper club band that has strings. That would ruin who we are. That, and he's like, no, you should, you know, and there was actually a nice thing on Facebook from Paul McCartney about this. And he talks about George sitting down with him and playing the song for him on the piano. And showing him the various voicings they could have and the different parts that could be played in the song and to give it this, you know, to give it this extra depth. And he and Paul went through it and, you know, arranged the song. And, you know, and Paul was able to, you know, his sort of supernatural musicality and then George's, you know, practical know-how of how to chart and arrange strings, they, you know, came up with an arrangement. And, you know, that's sympathy and the fact that, you know, he could go with them into Tomorrow Never Knows and into them into Sgt. Pepper and I Am the Walrus, you know, a brilliant arrangement. And, you know, to coach them all the way to rescue them when Magic Alex, you know, had no studio ready for them when they, in the middle of, you know, and Let It Be, they're like, oh, let's move into Apple Studios and record. Well, there's no deck here because we have a lunatic or a fraud running our studio. So George came to the rescue and brought in a big recorder, you know, big deck from Abbey Road for them, so they could record in their own Apple Studios, you know, to finally to nurse them through the final Abbey Road to get that, you know, to bring those snippets together in the medley and to do all that, you know, there, that's worth being fifth Beatle, you know. And then Neil Aspinall, of course, who was there from the beginning, who drove the van, who did the accounts, who paid the expenses, who even when the band finally ended, you know, kept the Apple thing ticking along, you know, who just sort of nursed this, his, you know, even when the Beatles were out, you know, and Apple was nothing, he still kept it going, and, you know, and was there when it was time to kind of revive it again in the 80s, 90s with the CDs and the anthology and stuff. So I think all of them are deserving of the fifth Beatle tag. You know, whoever you want to give it to, I'm fine with that. But okay. Really, to me, if I was voting myself, I would vote for George Martin. I think of all the people, of all the luck that they had, he was the luckiest break, you know, just someone who was, you know, so imaginative himself, you know, that listen to I Am the Walrus, listen to the strings in that, listen to what he did in Strawberry Fields. It's amazing, you know. And I said during Completely Beatles that I always felt like Paul's being more involved in his arrangements of the songs, they're more reflective of Paul, and I think Paul is a little bit more middle of the road than George Martin was himself. Mm-hmm. So you listen to something that's very strident and interesting, like Eleanor Rigby or Strawberry Fields or I Am the Walrus or Glass Onion, you get a real feel of when he could be really imaginative with his string arrangements and stuff like that. Yeah, but lightning only strikes once, you know, and so it's very hard to get it to strike twice. So you're never going to find another Beatles again, and I think for him, you know, the rest of his career, you know, he kind of produced this person, that person, but I don't, you know, you're never gonna, you know, America isn't the Beatles. Cheap Trick isn't the Beatles. You know, it's interesting, but yeah. I kind of feel like, you know, and Jeff Beck, you know, it was probably very interesting, but I just feel like he just didn't do as much work in the latter half of his career as he did in the.
So, all right. That was Dave saying he didn't have much to say about George Martin, and that was a half hour. So for those of you that have listened to Completely Beatles, please enjoy that extra half hour kind of bonus. If you've never listened to Completely Beatles and that sounded sort of interesting to you, have I got a podcast for you? It's Completely, and it's spelt completely wrong.
But completely right part. If you're a Beatles fan.
Sure, fair enough. But we have that both on our Sneaky Dragon page, sneakydragon.com, and also it's on iTunes. So if you want to hear Dave talk about more of that stuff with me interrupting, going, what? Then that is probably a good podcast for you.
Here's how you think of the show, Completely Beatles.
All right.
It's two friends
talking
about the Beatles.
Until they're enemies.
Is that what happens?
No, it's okay.
I didn't feel like that.
I like one person's description. It's Bert and Ernie.
Yeah.
You know, going on about something.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's interesting reading reviews of the thing, and just some people really get it. Some people don't get it. Some people get mad. Some people get happy. You decide.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's our other podcast. So thank you very much for the George Martin talk, Dave.
Oh, no problem.
All right.
Like I say, I could try to talk for another hour about George Martin.
And you know where you can get Dave to do that is invite him to your podcast and ask him about that. And boy, he will go to town. So, or here's another thing, and I'm trying to encourage people to do this. If you got a favorite podcast that you think Dave would be good on, talk to that podcast and go invite that Dave guy on. Don't invite me on, though. I'm busy. I don't want to like travel that much.
Well, you don't have to go anywhere. You just talk on your
Ugh, phone. I can't talk on the phone. I got phone phobia, so yeah, I don't like doing that.
That's true.
I've been listening to a book, Bonnie McFarlane's You're Better Than Me. She's a local Vancouver comedian who's done well in the States.
Okay.
And she also has a phone phobia. And I'm like, oh, it's nice reading about someone else who has a phone phobia.
Yeah.
She, to the point where she has trouble ordering pizza because she thinks they're going to call her on some stuff and embarrass her. And I got a little bit of problem ordering pizza. I got to like write stuff down beforehand. I can't just freeball that kind of nonsense.
Yeah
it's just phones. Oh, they're worst.
I'm not a big fan of them.
And yet you answer your landline.
Yeah.
They're just bizarre in this
day. I don't mind
age.
Answering the phone. I don't like calling people.
Because okay.
I feel like I'm disturbing people by calling them.
Yeah.
I'm okay answering the phone because people are calling me. They want to talk to someone, I assume. That's why they're calling.
Yeah, they want your money.
I don't have any problem
with
that.
Or to scam you.
They want to scam me. They are welcome to try.
I don't know if we've updated this, but the scam that you got scammed, not you.
I did not get scammed on it.
But the person tried to scam you.
Yes, the attempted scam.
Now, this was saying you owed money on your taxes, was that?
That's right.
Right.
$1,500.
And the cops were on their way or something.
There was an arrest warrant had been issued.
That's right.
They're coming to get me.
Yeah, you can hear the sirens in the distance. But apparently that became a very popular scam.
Yeah.
And so that was in the newspapers and all such.
It was very well organized. I mean, they had it set so that when the phone rang, it showed Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Although clearly they did not have an Ontario accent. I will say that right out.
Oh, let's hear what an Ontario accent sounds like.
As
someone who lived in Ontario for a while, what's the accent?
Donald Sutherland.
Oh.
If you hear someone, The
Hunger Games.
The stereotypical Canadian accent.
Kiefer, put that down. Kiefer, Kiefer.
The stereotypical Canadian accent is the Ontario accent.
Okay, so that's the aboot.
That's the aboot.
Yeah. All right.
If you hear it like at its most extreme, that's what you'll hear.
Okay. Watch the last Hunger Games. So I have Donald Sutherland on the brain.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
How was it? Great.
No, it's all right. It's fine. It just looked like, let's just spend all the money in the world in this one for no fucking reason. You know, it's just like, you know, the first one starts with like an interesting idea, you know, just like, all right, so you basic bread and circuses and we're going to put the kids up there and we're going to do that. And it's dark and you're like, oh no, this is, oh geez. And this one just goes crazy banana pants. It's just like, just big spectacle and it's fine. But, you know, fuck, whatever. It's fine. It's fine.
I haven't
watched
it.
Fine.
I haven't
watched
it.
But here's the one thing you get when you watch when you watch it is you go, oh, this isn't really good, but man, these are good actors. Like just really good actors, packed full of like just people that can turn shit into gold.
Yeah.
So they're doing the best they can. It's the difference between watching this and say like a Divergent movie or whatever that was.
Allegiant.
What's that?
Allegiant.
Allegiant. Is that the next one? All the other ones.
Yeah.
All the other ones. Your Twilights, you know, his grand particle design, whatever the hell that one is, your superfluous decathlon, whatever the hell. There's one that's just like too much business. It's
superfluous
like,
maze runner?
It's one of these, there you're a fucking wizard, but it's not Harry Potter. It's like, oh, I found, there's this whole world you don't know about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Your spectaculous, stupid conferences, whatever the shit it was, or you know, hey, guess what? You're Neptune's kid. You know, you're the Poseidon dude. Any of the trilogy bullshit. But the problem is they're not good actors, right? But you got Jennifer Lawrence as your lead. You can just like leave the camera on her puss for a while, and you're like, oh, she's thinking.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm interested. Oh, there's depth here. She's a really good actor. You know, it's like, you know, one of the worst actors you've got is Woody Harrelson. You're doing all right. I think that guy's got an Academy Award. Like, the worst fucking dude has an Academy Award.
Do you think he's a bad actor?
I think of this one. He just, like, scowls through the whole thing and just like, I don't know. I don't know what you're... Well, it's a bad idea.
He's catching a check, is that what you're telling me?
Oh, I just like to drink. Don't want to be... Yeah, you know. And at one point you're going like, I wonder how much Philip Seymour Hoffman footage they've got.
Yeah.
How are they going to pull this off?
Yeah.
To the point where at the end, they read a letter from Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. I'm like, well, that probably was Philip Seymour Hoffman in the book. But everyone's a damn good actor. Like, everyone, you're going like, I can see everyone in this is accepting an Academy Award and then coming to do this dumb thing.
Yeah.
You know? But and that's what makes the difference. It's kind of like with Harry Potter.
Yeah.
You know, once you get to Hogwarts... Again, it's silly, and the, you know, the trolls don't look realistic, and the snake looks dumb, but everyone there is an amazing actor who does Shakespeare,
yeah.
And they're all just like chewing scenery like nobody's business and trying not to be the worst actor in the group.
Yeah.
So everyone's going to town, and that just brings the kids acting up,
yeah.
And so it's fine, you know, but then you get all the rest of the films, and it's just like, ugh.
Nobody wants that.
Maze Runner, Scorch Trials,
I saw Maze Runner. I've not seen Scorch Trials.
How was Maze Runner?
Well, it's one of those films, once again, where you're kind of like, why not build a ladder? Why not just build a ladder and climb out?
Right. I mean, you look at World War Z, those zombies, they had a big wall to get over.
World War Z.
They all just did a little pylon and then got up over the top.
Of course, they were willing to sacrifice the... There was no sense of self, you know, there's...
And a good grasp of physics and knowing the power of making a pyramid to get up to the top. Yeah. They didn't try a whole bunch of like single lines.
No, they didn't put ladders up and try climbing.
No, those zombies knew. They went like, let's form a nice arch.
There's a limited amount of people in Maze Runner.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, there's a limited amount of kids, teenagers who are being tested or whatever it's going on.
Yeah. Like I went to see, I watched Star Wars again the other day.
The Force Awakens?
Yes.
Did you come out of it with less impressed or more impressed?
I thought it was better than the first time I saw it.
Is that right? Because your expectations were changed?
It wasn't expectations. It was just like, oh, this is kind of a charming little film.
Yeah.
This is fine. You know, maybe it wasn't, you know, expecting too much this time around.
Mm-hmm.
It was fine. It was like, oh yeah, everyone's likable. It's okay. That's dandy.
I really liked it a lot. And
yeah.
I think it's I don't know. I saw it twice and I thought it held up quite well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't need to see it again. Done.
Except when it comes on Netflix. Why not? Why not?
I don't know. I saw it in IMAX. I saw it in big screen, and I saw it in IMAX.
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to watch it on my TV at home? Seems a little bit of a down.
Yeah, the one character I thought, like, you see someone like a Chewbacca in there and just go, you know, you don't really even need Chewbacca. It's nice that they brought Chewbacca, but Chewbacca does nothing. Chewbacca does absolutely nothing. And they had a thing recently. I'm not going to say what happens at the end, but people are like, why doesn't Chewbacca hug Leia at the end? And I'm like, I always thought there was the reason he doesn't hug Leia at the end. He hugged her earlier. And so we got one hug. We don't need a second Chewbacca hug.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah.
But J.J. Abrams apparently went, yeah, it was kind of a mistake on my part not making the second hug. Mm. Like, okay, fine. All Chewbacca's doing is giving big hugs and just hanging around and just being there and going, and doing nothing and occasionally going like, hey, you want to hold my gun? Try it. Okay, well, now that guy can hold the gun. Well, then we don't need Chewbacca. What's Chewbacca's fucking deal? What's why we got Chewbacca here?
But was he like a big deal in the other movies?
Yeah, he was like the big threatening guy who like tear your arms off. He was like the thing that could lose it at any point. He was, you know, when you thought in the first movie, we were not sure about Han Solo. Before we thought Han Solo was super good, this is the goon.
I'll give you that in the first movie.
Tear your arms off because of a game of chess that's going wrong.
Sure, but by that third movie, he's pretty much just there as well.
Yeah, he's a big teddy bear by that point.
Yeah. I think his character's... I don't know. His character's kind of gone where it's gone. I mean, there's not much he can do.
He needs to tear some fucking arms off.
He doesn't talk.
He needs to tear some arms off.
That'd be all right.
That's what he's got to do. Because you got to cut an arm off at some point in a future movie. And how are you going to do that? Who's going to do it?
Yeah.
Chewbacca, who, again, I'm not going to say what happens in the movie, but Chewbacca has the right to tear an arm off.
Yeah.
Rip. Done.
I'm a little choked that we have to wait till, 2018 for the next one, something like that?
Yeah. They're showing the Rogue Squadron first. Are they doing that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it'd be fine, but... I want to see what's going on.
Yeah.
I want to see the next one.
And there's going to be a couple of Star Wars TV shows coming out, too. And we're going to be all Star Wars'd up.
Yeah. Out.
Yeah. I still think, you know, again, some people have been talking about... I know you didn't care for the Ghostbusters trailer, but some people have been
talking... Oh, no, I thought it was fine. Oh,
okay. But let me get into... I'll get into this point, then we can get into that. Whereas there's some people who are like, well, this is ruining my childhood that this movie is coming out because I love this movie and it's fucking up my childhood. And the response to that has been like, no movie can ruin your childhood's love of the movies. You know, a remake can't ruin this. And I think there's a little something that could be said about this movie kind of ruining, not ruining, but like tainting the Star Wars movies in that it completely kills the happy ending. It basically like makes everything go back to status quo. There's nothing at the beginning of this movie that isn't where the Star Wars films were at the beginning of the Star Wars movies. It's exactly the same. You know, evil still has about the same amount of power. Good is still struggling. So what'd you do those three fucking movies? You know, you blew up a couple of things, but fuck, man, we can make other things. So who cares? Nothing. You did nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice sacrifice, guys, and everything you did, but didn't really matter. The end. And so what can you do with this film series? Can you actually make a difference, or do you just put it back to the status quo at the end of this one, too? Or what do you do, Dave?
It's a good question. I'm curious to see what they're going to do. I it's hard to talk about the movie. I don't mind talking about it to you, but I feel difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult to talk about it because I don't want to spoil it for people.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And so, you know, I'm curious to see where they go. I think that they put a great base in for where I think that they want to go. Like, I have this idea of where they're going, and I'm curious to see if that's what happens.
It's just, it feels like something like, speaking, you look at something like the Harry Potter movies.
Let's look at them.
All right, which are also books and well worth a read as in book form. But like, so you have your whole story, and by the time you get to the end of the story, is the world any different than it was at the start of the story? Like, the characters are older.
Yeah.
They've grown. Mm-hmm. Some characters have died along the way, a la Star Wars. But are things any different?
Yeah.
Are they? How are they different?
Well, I think we can assume, and I hope this is where that will remain forever so, that Voldemort is gone. There's no more threat of, you know, him to ever returning and causing the kind of problems that he caused in the past and in the present of in the stories.
So you feel but there still are. Dementors still exist.
Yeah.
The Death Eaters, you think that cult is completely broken?
Well, I think without Voldemort, I don't think that they have much, you know. I mean, I'm sure there's still problems.
Right. But where we start in the Harry Potter book, basically Voldemort is, spoiler for the first Harry Potter story, he's a guy on the back of another dude's head.
Yeah.
And he's not much of a threat, really, then. Really? Is he that much of a threat? He's more of an annoyance. He's more, he's someone people don't talk about, but he's not causing any major damage.
Yes, but he's growing in power.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe he's going to grow in power. Yeah. That's possible. But at the start of the story and then at the end of the story, and the things aren't really that different in the world at all. And I find that's the case with almost all those big stories. It's just like, you never have
Are you talking about like the whole run of them or the just
the whole first run. Book? Like, what, you get the first one and then you get the last one. I'm talking about like almost any of these kind of things. You know, it's like you have the start, you have the end. Is there any difference?
Yes. I mean, let's say it's, you could say the same thing with World War II. Right? I mean, after World War II, Hitler's dead. There's still Nazis. There's still people, there's still racist people who have these weird, idea of racial characteristics and stuff like that that extends into our time. But did something change during World War II? Yes, I think that there was a positive outcome to the war. Just the same way that in Harry Potter is a positive outcome to that battle.
Okay.
You know?
That's an interesting way to put it. All right.
I mean, in some ways, how about just the fact that it exposed all these people who were Death Eaters, you know, exposed who they were, you know, whether it's Umbridge or the Malfoys and those people who were, you know, kind of hiding behind this cloak of respectability or power or whatever, you know, and the fact that, and I think that the kids grew as well. I think that, you know, Harry Potter changed. He grew as a person from a callow youth to someone who you could use power, but also be respectful of his power, you know. I mean, he's the person who killed Voldemort. Now, he's the most powerful person in a sense, but in another way, not really, because what the power that Harry Potter had was the power of the community of fellow wizards to defeat Voldemort. It's not just him who does it. That's my problem with the film, and that's why I love the book more, is that in the book, it is a community of action that destroys Voldemort, not one person's actions.
No, I like your comparing.
Which is, of course, is an American version of reality, right?
I like it. No, I like your comparing it kind of the World War II. That does make sense. Like, I think then, to me, my problem with Star Wars is, then you basically start with the Nazis are in charge. It looks like we beat the Nazis. Cut to later, the Nazis are in charge again.
Well, don't think of it as the Nazis. How about think of it as...
except the Nazis have changed their name to, you know, something, the Ratsies.
Sure.
But it's the same general outfits.
Yeah.
Swastika is a little different.
You know what? I mean, realistically, such a thing could happen again. It's not beyond the realm of comprehension that another militaristic fascist dictatorship takes over, led by some person with a terrible comb over and orange skin that you just wouldn't think of as a threat, but who takes over a country and is able to bend the people to you know, his insane will, and create some sort of horrible dictatorship that causes death and destruction on the world.
What's coming, I think, isn't World War II. I think what's coming is Marvel. I know you were going to do this as well, but a civil war. Like, it feels like there's such a radical, there's the folks that are, you know, pro Hillary and pro Bernie, and like and you see like the backing behind like Bernie, and they go like, okay, and then you got the backing behind Trump. You're like, okay, and it's like, oh, how are these, like, when someone does win next year?
Yeah.
There's gonna be a lot of fucking people mad. Like, there's gonna be a lot of people who are very, very, very upset living in that same country for like 4 years.
Well,
that,
I think
more so than I think in the past.
I think if you took the numbers and looked at the entire population of the United States, it's actually a pretty small amount of people who are that into it.
That would be nice to think. Yeah,
I think
I think there's people that are fed up. I think on both sides, and I think they're looking for someone that's not talking political baffle gap. And I think that's why the two of them have done so well, is because they seem to, even though they couldn't be more different, both are actually saying what they believe, and you buy that instead of, well, you know, there's many ways to look at the subject.
Yeah.
You know, and doing what Hillary does, which is the political speech, which actually is actually more realistic, because that's the kind of thing you're actually going to have to fucking do when you're actually in charge. You can't just go, I feel this way, and I'm going to do it. Boom. Nope. You got to make deals and do this and compromise and do that.
Compromise is the main word.
Yeah.
And And I just think we talked about this a little bit after the election in Canada. Is I just feel like in our current Facebook culture, mm-hmm. our 110% for and 110% against culture, mm-hmm. that we see this division much more than we would if we didn't have it. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels like the way the dialogue is now, it's so polarized that there is no one wants to find any middle ground within a subset of people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not everyone. Not everyone is posting Bernie Sanders stuff on the internet, and not everyone is posting Donald Trump stuff on the internet. There's a group of people who are, and there's a group of people who aren't, and they're the ones who are at odds with each other. Now, how much taste those two groups have to actually pick up arms and start some sort of general onslaught against each other in a real civil war, if that's what you're suggesting. I kind of doubt it.
No, I don't think arms are how they're going to go about doing it, and I'm not sure how they're going to go about doing it. But like here's where I see a spark about to go off. Is like I see the Donald Trump rallies, and there's almost always now it feels like a black person who's protesting, mm-hmm. and then he's like, get him out of here. And then they're really treated roughly as they get out.
Yeah.
And there was one that they had up on like 2 days ago, and it was a person who was leaving, and then someone in the audience just sucker punches them hard.
Yeah.
And they go down, and they're staggering, and they wander still up the stairs a bit more. And then the security guards grab that person who was sucker punched and wrestle them to the ground, and the other guy, nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, okay. Okay, so that on itself is like, ugh.
Let me just defend the action of security guards just for 1 second.
Okay,
which is, if they did something to the guy who was sucker punched, that's a problem.
That was sucker punched, yeah.
They did something to the guy who was sucker punched, right?
Yeah.
They took him out. I mean, that's for that person's safety and for the safety of the crowd, who if you went to try to accost the person who sucker punched him, you'd end up with a big problem of people who are defending him.
Gotcha.
And you get,
but they basically took this person to the ground.
Yes,
hard.
I know.
It's terrible.
I mean, to be honest with you, I have not been watching any of these things because
right.
I just feel like it's just a giant circus.
Fair enough. But there's something that is kind of hard to ignore, which is when you've got then the Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. that basically is putting forward a good argument that there's a lot of racist police officers, and it does not matter what you do, the police officers can just take you out and they won't be punished for this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you're a black person in the States, you feel, oh, I got to watch out for the cops. Okay. But what have I got going on? Well, Obama's president. I got that much.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's some... And when something tragic happens, he does come out and he does say things that do soothe and calm. Now, the idea that maybe Trump would be president and the guy who's going, get that person out of here, and people are getting sucker punched and knocked down and treated like shit, then it's like, oh, you've now cut off two things. You've cut off, like, the government is no help to you. In fact, they're against you, and the police are against you.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit, what do you got? That's where the powder keg just goes kaboom.
It's a giant step backwards. That's for certain.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I'm glad about is that we live in a culture where everyone's got a fucking phone in their pocket with a camera on it, and you can't get away with shit for all the people who are complaining about... You used to complain about too many security cameras, you know, on streets and whatever. It's just like, well, it doesn't matter because everyone's got a goddamn camera now and everything's being recorded. So I don't know. Maybe we're just seeing more of what this is now. And maybe it's always been like this and we're just seeing it, you know, for the first time. But Jesus Christ, when I see the rallies and all this, I'm just like, how is this fucking possible that you would, ugh. It is unbelievable.
Mm.
It is unbelievable. Then I see, like, this morning, you see, like, President Obama and Prime Minister Trudeau, and you see those two guys together, and they're talking, and they're joking about hockey, and they're doing all this kind of stuff, and just go, well, this is a nice moment. I'm gonna just savor this for a while before, you know, whatever happens. But geez, Louise. This seems like two sensible fellas, you know, who have a conversation. No one's perfect, I'll give you that, but it just feels like, you both seem rational. I trust both of you with my car keys or something. Like, I just trust both of you generally.
Sure.
You know? But it's little scary times right now is what it feels like to me. A little scary.
Hmm.
Not so much to you?
No.
Okay.
It's because I just feel like it's still kind of silly season, and hopefully things will rate themselves. I'm an optimist, so I'm an optimistic pessimist. So I know I don't really trust the political systems. So I think mm-hmm. that keep it grassroots, people.
Okay, grassroots. Fair enough. Keep it grassroots. Dave is a hippie. Okay, back to the Ghostbusters thing. Yeah. Okay, what did you think of the trailer?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I did post a little thing. I said...
you're hoping they're keeping all the
jokes. I said they're keeping the jokes for the movie, right?
Right.
Which I was kind of joking. It was seemed kind of odd because like Melissa McCarthy is very subdued in the trailer.
Except where she's smashing someone through a plate glass window. She grabs a person by their neck, smashes them through a window.
Oh, that's when she's possessed?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hmm. And then, yeah, that's okay. But anyway, it's just, yeah, I mean, it just felt kind of like, but you know, you're like, it just, I don't know, there's a lot of fan service in it, which mm-hmm. is one thing which, yeah. you know, it's like, as someone who's not a huge fan of the first Ghost, like the original Ghostbusters movie.
I'm oh,
not,
is like, that right?
You don't I'm not like a big fan one? Of it. Okay. It's okay. I mean, but I'm, you know, I've seen it twice. Mm-hmm. I watched it more recently because I always felt kind of cool to it, and I was kind of like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people were right. And I watched it, and I thought, it was okay. It's okay. But, you know.
It's definitely a movie of its era. Mm. Man, there's a lot of smoking in it. Oh, man, yes. Everyone's smoking.
Smoking.
And there's the scene that, like, I remember they showed it in the park, here at Stanley Park, for mm-hmm. families.
Okay.
And I'm like, you guys all forgot about the blowjob scene, didn't you? Y'all forgot about that weird Dan Aykroyd ghost blowjob scene. That's just like, this is of the era as well. This is of the era.
And yeah, so when I watch it, like when the Ecto-1 comes out, I guess I'm supposed to be like, ooh, they're driving that car or whatever. But I'm not. I'm just kind of like, there's that car. And then, you know, they're in the costumes and stuff. And I guess once again, you're supposed to be like, ladies are wearing the costume from the movie. Oh boy, so much stuff is coming from the original film. This is great. But I'm not. I'm like, you know, there's a great scene with Kate McKinnon and she's wearing a blue wig and a hat. And then she scares Kristen Wiig's character and she's like, it's the hat, right? It's too much. And that's funny.
Yeah.
More of that. But don't. But at the same time, I'm like, why am I saying this? Because my
Save
it for the movie. My biggest complaint about the Scott Pilgrim campaign was that they wasted all their great jokes in the trailer. So when you went to see the film, you know, and you would say
which I completely disagree with, but go ahead.
When you're watching the film and you... I still think it's a pretty good film. Actually, I think it's a very good film. But it was just disappointing for me to be watching the movie and then have the scene where he's like, I love bread. I could eat it all day long, you know, and then it's like, except it makes you fat. Bread makes you fat? I would have loved to have laughed at that and have that fresh moment in the film seen it.
But the Scott Pilgrim trailer is 2 minutes long at most.
But no, it was not just one trailer, though. They did like a series of almost six trailers with different jokes from the film.
I understand that. But the Scott Pilgrim film is so dense with jokes. It's so packed in a way that most movies aren't.
Yeah.
Which most movies are, we're going to set up something that's going to happen at the end of a minute.
Sure.
And now we're going to set up something that's going to happen at the end of this minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the Scott Pilgrim movie is the setup's funny, the follow-through's funny, now we're going to have something in the background that's funny, then we're going to have this that pays off as well. Yeah. And so...
But they're best
jokes.
They're
very generous.
Their best jokes were put into the, in my opinion, the best jokes they threw in the trailers, just so we knew.
Okay.
The film's going to be really good.
Fair enough.
Here's the good jokes.
Okay.
Come on down. Watch them again.
That could very well be. Yeah, they've got a European trailer that's out as well, too, that throws some extra stuff into it.
I don't need to see it now. I've seen it. I'll go see it. I'm interested in the film.
Oh, everyone's going to go see it. And you know who's going to go see it? Everyone who's complaining about it is going to go see it because they want to go see it so they can complain about it. Mm-hmm. But here's the nice thing. Those dollars count as actual dollars. They take those dollars at par. $8 are fine. $10 counts as 10 real dollars.
What did you think of the trailer?
I thought I liked it, actually. You know, I thought what was weird was...
Were you excited like to see Ecto-1 and all that kind of stuff? Would that make
No, because I expected that was going to happen. Yeah. What I liked seeing, you know, the guy on stilts ghost that's walking through Times Square who's dressed as like Uncle Sam. I went like, oh, that's an interesting, weird little visual.
I don't really care about that stuff, so it didn't really...
I like the idea of like a bunch of... You know, Times Square seems like a good place to have like a bunch of ghosts. I'm like, oh, that sounds that.
Who's directing it? In Paul Feig.
Yeah, from Bridesmaids.
Not a very good director, so I don't.
He was good in Bridesmaids. He directed that well.
He can point a camera at people who are funny. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I have not seen him do action. We'll see how that goes.
I saw Spy.
Yeah, there's some good stuff in Spy.
Yep, it's pretty good.
Yeah, that was a genre thing. He directed the action scene off the top well. Don't you think?
I don't know if he did it. I don't know if he has second unit people doing
it. Oh, we're going to play that card, hey? Well, then maybe he'll second unit this one. I don't know. That doesn't affect me one way or the damn other.
I
love the first Ghostbusters movie. The second Ghostbusters movie is not good.
You love even more.
No, terrible. Did not get the second Ghostbusters movie. Forgot what the first Ghostbusters movie was about.
Yeah.
The only thing that's weird in the first Ghostbusters movie.
What was the first one about? Like, what do you mean? It forgot what it was about.
Oh, the first one was about working class guys who were scammers.
But they're not working class. They're all like professors and stuff like that, aren't they?
No, but when they start their own business,
okay,
that's a working class business. That's starting up your own.
But aren't they serious? They're not scamming.
Okay, but they were scamming. That's the thing. Bill Murray is a scammer off the top. He's doing that psychic thing where he's shocking the guy and he's telling the pretty girl, "You're psychic. You're right." He's a scammer. Okay. He's bullshitting. Well, the other two guys are doing their thing, but they don't know if it's right or not.
Yeah.
They're shocked when they finally find like ectoplasm and they see a ghost at the library.
Yeah.
Basically, it's three guys who have been in college too long, who the college guys kick out because they've been in college too long and they've come up with nothing, who all of a sudden, your bullshit is right.
Yeah.
What are you going to do now? I don't know.
Call the Ghostbusters.
Well, and so you get like kicked out of college, and so you then get that beat, which is fun, which is just like, well, what do we do now? I don't know. Let's start our own business because we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
So they start their own business and it's working for them, but then it's very successful. But then, you know, then we take it up to the
Of course it is. They're renting real estate in New York City.
Yeah, and then we get like way over their heads. And I love that it takes you up to the point where these guys who were real assholes, really, at the beginning. They're assholes.
Right.
Okay, like Egon's the only one who's not, and that's because something's mentally wrong with that guy. He wanted to drill in his own head, and he got stopped, and that's the only reason he did. They get to the point where they're going to have to make the big sacrifice to at least have a chance of saving the world.
Yeah.
And they're all sitting around going like, we're basically realizing we're going to have to die. And I love the scene that they've got where they're all realizing they're going to die. And Bill Murray steps up and just goes, I love this plan. Let's do it. And they're all like, yes, let's do it. Let's go. It's a great scene. That's where the heart is. Yeah. That's where the emotion is.
Yeah.
Here we go. And so that's what makes it. And the second one, they get on a magical Statue of Liberty, walk it through the East River, and it's a bunch of bullshit. It's garbage. Yeah. The only thing that doesn't make sense in the first film is the Ernie Hudson character, because he just shows up and does nothing.
Yeah.
And he's a good actor, and you even have a scene where you actually sort of see what he could be, where it's him and Dan Aykroyd, and they're in the car, and talking about Judgment Day, and he's talking about how I like Jesus' style. Mm. And it's like, oh, he's a Christian.
Yeah.
What's it like for a Christian with all this kind of stuff? And he's trying to like combine it, and Dan Aykroyd isn't poo-pooing what he's saying. He's just like, yeah, this is probably Judgment Day. Mm. It's like, oh, that's interesting. Okay, so how are you dealing with this, because you're not a scammer, you're just the guy who's coming in because it's a job,
but then
you realize that this is all real. What's his deal? And so they don't really pay that off, and I think that's the big flaw in that film. And it looks like hopefully in this film they're starting off with the kind of Ernie Hudson character, you know, off earlier on,
having a stronger
and film. She's got like a reason to
although
be there.
Her character is pretty standard black character,
though the problem with that is She's been doing stand-up for like 23 years, that actress. She's a stand-up comedian.
Okay.
She's come into success in about the last 2 or 3 years on Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
And I know people are saying this is a stereotype, but it's what her comedy character is. That's her beat when she does stand-up. So what do you do with her?
Yeah.
Do you make her a scientist and say, fuck, don't do the stuff that you do that you know works?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we've got Chris Rock. Chris Rock, don't act like Chris Rock. What we want you to do, put on these glasses, and I want you to act like Egon. No, you fucking let Chris Rock be fucking Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Because I think that was something that worked with the first Ghostbusters movie, too, was you had Bill Murray being Bill Murray. The Bill Murray we want to see Bill Murray being. He's being the comedy type. He's worked through. Dan Aykroyd is being the nerdy, twitchy guy. That's a good Dan Aykroyd type. Harold Ramis, he's not a good actor. What do we do with Harold Ramis?
Yeah.
Well, you know, he looks like a weirdo. Let's make him generally quiet. Doesn't speak much. When he does, he's a freak. Works. Perfect. Ernie Hudson then becomes the regular guy who we could have him kind of being our everyman commenting and stuff, but they don't get him in early enough in the movie to do that. And it feels like with this movie, they're making everyone do the type that they've been doing in other movies and do well. And I think that is a really good idea for how you want to do a movie like this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, first thing.
You hate women. Please continue.
First thing, you've kind of sold me on Ghostbusters with your description of that scene. That was very nice. Second is, I've often wondered if there any Hudson character isn't a kind of a reference to the original Ghostbusters film with Bob Hope and Eddie Rochester.
Oh.
So I've often wondered...
Why don't you explain what that film is?
Well, it's been a while since I saw it, but it came out in the 40s, and in it, it is not Bob Hope driving around in the Ecto-1. In that film, he is somehow tasked with going to this house, this haunted house, and ridding it of ghosts. And Eddie Rochester is his assistant. And so you get a lot of comedy of that time, of wide-eyed black person.
Yeah.
But also Bob Hope being a coward.
Being a wide-eyed coward.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good film. Like, from that time period, he did some good films. My favorite.
Bob Hope did good Coward Who Liked the Ladies.
My favorite brunette, classic film of him as a baby photographer who is looking after a private detective's office, and a sultry woman comes in and hires him as a private detective. And so this baby photographer then has to pretend to be a private dick.
Oh, I gotta watch a little of that. It's also not connected with the Ghostbusters that Filmation did in the early 70s, which was Storch. It's the guy from F Troop.
Larry Storch.
Larry Storch. Forrest Tucker, Forrest I want to say.
Also from F
Troop. Yeah, and a guy in a gorilla outfit who I think they just called Tracy. They just named him
Spencer Tracy.
That was it. Spencer Tracy at a gorilla outfit. His final role. And so it's the three of them in a jalopy, and they go out and they stop ghosts, and they've got a device that, like, which bugged me as a kid, which basically destroys ghosts. I'm like, but that's your soul. You've just destroyed an immortal soul. That's horrible. But later, I think they somehow made it that they sent the ghost to the afterlife or something. Yeah. And later on, after the Ghostbusters movie became successful, they did an animated version of that as well.
We had that videotape at my in-law's house.
And the original series, as all 70s series, cranked that laugh track as high as it would go. Oh, the laugh track loved everything so very much. By the way, when I was talking about Room 222 last week, I didn't remember that it had a laugh track, and there was a half hour. I assumed it was an hour-long drama. It was a half-hour comedy. Yeah. And I've watched a couple since, and it was James L. Brooks who was the creator of it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they used the same font, it looks like, that both Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Island used for their starring in the, you know, when they
oh
when
really
they come, yeah not off the top
because the Room 222 is like a chalk on a chalkboard.
Yeah, but when they come in and these, you know, all the different actors that are in that episode, you know, it's that yellow font from like Brady Bunch. I'm like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder if this was a cheap font.
I guess it was pretty common.
Yeah, it was pretty common. I don't know how they did it back then, but I assume this was pretty easy to do.
Interesting. All right, well, two little bits of business. Actually, I just want, before we go on to our bits of business, I just want to, today at work, we had a terrific windstorm. It was a lot of fun and really rainy.
You don't mean a windstorm of savings.
I do not mean a windstorm
of savings.
You're
not blowing the doors down with the garage doors.
The wind was literally blowing the doors down.
So you surrounded yourself with garage doors for safety.
But when we came in, there was this weird high-pitched moan, like a woman. Like, it was weird.
Yeah.
And one of the guys I worked with said, "What a creepy noise." Like, how'd you like to be here in the dark hearing that? So I wouldn't want to be here by myself.
Yeah.
And I was listening to it, and I was like, yeah, that is a great noise. Like, that is scary noise. And I was thinking, I mentioned seeing this film last week. I mentioned seeing this film called House of the Devil, which I thought was pretty good. But I was thinking about what it lacked for me, which was it lacked scariness. Like, it didn't have like a scary element. Like, the girl in the film, the girl is babysitting for these people that are kind of creepy, introduce them as creepy, and you know that she's in danger because something that happens in the film, but you're never, so it's more you're waiting to see what's going to happen because she's babysitting. So she's just kind of hanging around the house, walking down the hallways, checking in rooms, looking at this, looking at that, breaks something, sweeps it up and throws it away, orders pizza, you know, just. And it's just kind of, you're waiting for something to happen. Like, you're like, well, what's, you know, but you're not like on the edge of your seat. There's no noise, you know? And I think, and I always go back to one of my favorite scary things, which is A Simple Drop of Water from Mario Bava's, I believe it's Black Sabbath, or if that, I might be wrong. Anyway, his kind of one man portmanteau, whatever you call it. Like, you know, it's a three segments, different segments, different little, like, and the one, it's so scary, not because of, there are some scary things in it, but it's scary because of the atmosphere it creates. you know, a woman alone in her apartment and water dripping and going and turning it off and then it's starting again. And, you know, and it creates this, you know, it heightens this sense of danger and, you know, and has, but it's not just the noise. It's the blinking neon sign outside her room. It's what you saw before she ended up going back to her apartment that kind of creeped you out. And it, you know, keeps kind of upping this ante. And this film doesn't have that. It doesn't have that sense of foreboding that something repeating of, you know, this noise that she's hears and she doesn't know where it's coming from. It doesn't do anything like that, you know, and it needed that. It needs it. I think one of the most important things in a horror film is the soundtrack. You know, is how the sound, things that are happening, you know, that makes it seem more eerie and scary, you know. The girls and I watched Oculus during last week, and that's a pretty good film. It's a pretty interesting film. It's about a haunted mirror. Mm-hmm. So it's a haunted object film, and it creates hallucinations or delusions. So you're doing something, but you don't realize you're doing it. So like this man is trying to pull off his bandage. He's actually pulling out his fingernails, but he thinks he's pulling off his bandage.
Okay.
It's not done super gory. Like it's not done so it's torture horror, which I don't like. But it's done enough that you're creeped out by it, right? And there's other stuff it's interesting, right? And so in the film, you've got two stories. You have the brother and sister reuniting in the present. The boy is released from an insane asylum, and his sister has been kind of living her life. But her whole life is dedicated to destroying this thing, this mirror.
Right. Could I guess what the thing is? Could I guess? If it was Twilight Zone, what I would guess the situation was?
Okay, sure.
Okay, so you see, you're a mirror, and the mirror is like a little different, and things are really wrong in the mirror. Like, oh, we got to destroy the mirror. Can't destroy the mirror. We got to destroy the mirror. Can't destroy the mirror. In the end, you destroy the mirror. Find out you're the mirror.
No,
you've been the reflection the whole time.
No,
and so it's all these shattered pieces, and now you realize, you know, oh, fuck, I was the mirror the whole time. The other reality was the real reality.
That would have been interesting, too, but they did it differently than
that. All right, continue.
So in the film, so then it goes them returning to their childhood home where she has installed the mirror and all this video cameras and stuff like that so they can track what the mirror is doing.
Okay.
And then it goes back to the past when their family first moved there, mm-hmm. and their dad had bought this mirror, you know, as furnishing for the house. Not, you know, he didn't buy it. Like, oh, haunted mirror, I should put that in the house. No, he did buy it, you know, and then it starts to change what's happening. And the children, so you get their experiences as children as their parents start to go insane. And you get the experiences as they themselves are being driven insane by this mirror as young adults, and it's quite interesting actually. It's a pretty good film, it kind of knew how to make the scares. You know, it wasn't full of jump scares. There's a few things where the things are peeping out of nowhere and stuff like that. You know, and you're kind of like, ooh, ah. And Mary was very freaked out by it. I was mildly, you know, I'm not. There was a scene where I had like goosebumps, you know, but.
Right. So did you do a thing like later where you pretend you had to go to the washroom, you pause it, you go, you set up a big mirror in their room, and then they come back
that's
and
exactly
just go
right.
like, what?
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't.
What I went out to the shop, built a replica of the mirror, put it in my
room. Well, what you got to do is you got to like, watch the trailer first.
Yeah.
And you go like, what's the mirror look like? I'm like, okay. Then you build it. You spend the big scare and then you put it in there. It's like,
put it in the shop. Make sure the girls come in.
Or no, what you do is you say, "I got you this mirror.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working on it for a long time."
Yeah.
Anyway, and then you just like lay that pipe, and then like about maybe 2 weeks later, you go, "Let's rent the movie."
Yeah.
And then you go like, "Dad, you haven't seen this movie. How would I have seen this movie? I've never seen this movie." And then
let's,
you know,
let's rent this movie.
But you can't destroy Daddy's mirror that he made. I worked so hard, daughters. Please leave it there.
Yes. No, it's pretty good. But it just made me think about that film. And just in terms of like, just, you're kind of bugging me because it's a good film and it's interesting and it has an interesting story to tell. But there's something missing in it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just missing that.
It'd be interesting if someone laid out just almost like musical notes where you put the scares, where you build, and you just go like, all right, let's go with that. Like, I remember like when I saw that speaking of Ghostbusters, because they said they and this the trailer doesn't make it look this way, but they said
the porn parody, the Bust Ghosters.
No, though. Okay. Though they have a little bit of a joke like that in the European trailer. That's pretty good.
Okay.
So I'm just gonna tell you what it is, which is the Chris Hemsworth character is like, "I'll make some logos for you," and it's one of the ghosts, and the ghost just has enormous boobs. And it's like, I don't think that's good for what's wrong? Boobs not big enough. Pretty good. I have no idea what I was going to say. Please. Oh, yeah, I remember. Which was like the director has said he's going to try to put real scares into this. And I'm like, oh, what do you do? Yeah. Put real scares in a comedy.
Mm.
And I think I mentioned this before, but yeah, there's this short online about a woman who's turning a light on and off.
That's really good.
It's really good. Yeah. But you look at it and you go like, this is it. This is the rhythm, which is like, there's a regular action. Mm-hmm. That's like, oh, that's a little strange.
Yeah.
What's this? Oh, that's a little strange. Duplicate enough. What's this? You expect it now. Oh, that's a little strange.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go into this different area. Is that same thing duplicated? A little bit. Now I'm more curious than anything. I'm not scared. It's happened enough now that I'm not scared. But that's okay. Now we've got the third one. This is where you got to have the payoff.
Yeah.
Well, it's time for this. The thing occurs, and that's when you have the over-the-top horror thing occur.
Yeah.
Because we've now built up a rhythm of, you're mm-hmm. ready for this.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's not fine. That's the last one. And then you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But there's nothing in it that wouldn't be, you know, almost a G movie. There's nothing. It's just scary is all it is, mm-hmm. you know? But yeah, you do. I think if they did something with that rhythm, that would be right.
Mm-hmm.
That's like very close to like, just copy that. Anytime you need to do anything horror, that's a good series of beats.
I hope he can. I mean, like I say, I think he's an okay director. I think he's very good at pointing the cameras but you know, when you watch The Heat, you don't feel like, wow, what a great action, you know, comedy movie. Oh, the action in that was so good, you know.
Do you remember how people, I don't know if this was the case when you watched it, but the Large Marge scene in Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Freaked me out.
Freaked the audience the hell out.
Yeah.
People screamed.
Yeah.
You look at it now and just go, oh, that's just silly.
But you've seen it a few times.
You've seen it.
Yeah.
But in a movie theater where you've also set up the rhythm of just like, it's a friendly world where everything's nice, everything's great, and here's something. Ah! It's like, that's also how you do it. Yeah. You got to like set it, calm. Everything's calm. Here's the one thing immediately that's bad. And it's obviously a jump scare, but it's like so over the top that your brain can't really process it. And it's like, fucking God damn it. Gah!
It's very well done.
Yeah.
Of its time. I mean, now, if you showed it to people now, they'd be kind of like, oh, those aren't very good special effects. You're missing that point.
Yeah. We'll see when the new Pee-wee thing comes out, the new Pee-wee's Holiday, and everyone will go, I ruined my childhood, this, because I had the other thing, and I don't like new things are bad. Gobble, gobble, hey. And so on.
Okay.
And the second thing.
So, we had a request from a listener
after
our little horsing around segment last week.
Okay.
That I tell people who are not into horses, if you were at like the PNE, let's say, or an equivalent of that
Pacific National Exhibition here in Vancouver, that's our big fair.
Yeah, an agricultural fair that has a horse component to it. What you should go and see? Here's what you should go and see. Don't go see the dressage because that is a foreign language.
How about the RCMP musical ride?
That's fun, but I'm just thinking in terms of like not gimmicky, just like normal horse stuff.
All right.
I would say look for the jumping. Jumping is always good to watch. Always fun to watch, you know, because it's an element of risk. You know, obviously they're not going to go crazy high. That's Spruce Meadows. But they're going to have, you know, a certain amount of...
What's Spruce Meadows? Do they go really
Spruce high? Meadows, yeah, where they jump over, you know, kind of have those... The horses basically jump up in the air over a wall. You know,
okay. Like
that sort of... those sort of high jumps. If you go to see, like, kids riding in an exhibition, you're not going to see the greatest riding you've ever seen in your life. But it's interesting, right? Unfortunately, this year, Lisa is away. My wife is away. Last year was great. We did a jumping demonstration. And what was great is that she talked like it was a lesson to the kids. And it was really interesting to hear.
Neat.
Yeah, to hear like, you know, for the audience to be listening. I was like, oh man, I wish I'd seen something like this when I was just like watching horses. Because, you know, she was saying what you should be looking for. She wasn't saying it to the audience, but she was giving the audience a taste of, this is what you are looking for in a jump. This is what you're looking, as if you're a rider, this is what you want to be doing.
Okay.
You know, you want to, you know, approach the jump like this. You want to have this rhythm. You want to be, you know, and it's really interesting to watch. And I think, I mean, I almost wish that, you know, you could just say to people, here's what you should do. If you're doing an exhibition, get someone who knows what they're talking about and have them do, you know, in the demo, talk about, you know, almost do like a lesson, because it was really interesting.
Yeah.
Actually, even I was just in the ring as the lackey, you know, just setting up jumps that got knocked down, setting up the standards or the rails if they got knocked down. And so that was really interesting. But yeah, I would recommend, like, if you're just sort of semi into horses or
the jumps,
or that's kind of your action thing. You know, it's not. I enjoy watching dressage quite a bit, but then I know what I'm looking for.
Right.
I know. I'm when I'm watching, I'm thinking, oh, that's not a very good, that's not a collected trot. That's not a extended trot. They're not, you know, they're not doing, that's a terrible circle. That's not a half circle. What are you doing? You know, yeah. just
and you're
you know.
Screaming. You call that a trot?
Yeah, that's exactly what I do. I start yelling at the children.
Yeah,
throwing.
I've seen better trots from Trotsky.
Never said that.
Yeah, burn, and, sick burn.
And I'm glad.
Good for you. No, that's cool. I remember like one of the things.
That's from the Great Communists collection of criticisms.
That's right.
Yeah,
horsing around the communist edition. our listener, a couple of listeners, said they really liked. The horse talk mm-hmm. that you were worried about, that yes. you thought people would be bored. And they said, whatever you guys talk about, you know, it's interesting as long as you're interested, basically.
Yeah.
And my suggestion was that we combine horses in the Bible and we talk about famous horses of the Bible. So I made a list of all the horses that appear in the Bible.
You didn't make a list. You linked to a list. Let's
what
be fair.
I did was I copied it and I put it in. What the fuck? Why you gotta play me like that? All right. It's going to be like that, eh? All right. Sure. All right.
You made a
so
list.
I checked it twice.
Yes.
So it was there. So if you go to our Facebook page and you're kind of curious about like, hey, any horses in the Bible?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. In fact, one of the apostles was a horse. You don't find that out until the end of Luke. Try to guess who it is. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Oh, I'm curious. Was it Philip?
Yes.
Because the name Philip is, of course, horse lover.
Yes. Yep.
It's interesting that you say that because actually, I wrote a biography of...
He's the one, if you see like the Last Supper, he's the one that's eating all the oats just out of a basket.
Yeah, I wrote a biography of almost all the famous people in the world.
Uh-huh. What was it called?
I had to call the Wikipedia. Yeah.
Let's wrap this up, you son of a bitch.
No, before we go, I want to talk about something.
Oh, you said there was two things to talk about. That's why I figured
No. This is the second thing.
All right.
You linked...
That was clearly two things, though, right, folks?
Well, no. I said before we get to it, we're going to talk about this first.
All right. Fair enough.
So here's the other thing I want to talk a little bit about.
All right. Talk a little bit about it.
This was very interesting to me. You linked to an article, I think, by Ben Acker, by someone about writing, how to be a writer.
Oh, Ben McCool.
Oh, okay. I'm totally wrong. But anyway, you linked to this, and I thought it was really interesting what you had to say. And I just want you to kind of talk about your criticisms, not your criticisms, but your own kind of reactions to the article.
Sure, okay. Well,
the first thing was like writing every day.
Yeah, it was basically you got to write every day, write all the time. You got to write every day. If you don't write, you shouldn't call yourself a writer.
Mm.
And it was kind of insulting to people who wouldn't do that. It said you've got to, you know, be prepared to give up sleep, be prepared to flake off with social obligations.
Yeah.
Because this is what being a writer is. And that was the one, there was four things that were said, and I forget what the other three were, but that was the one that when I first read, I felt like, this feels a little whiplash to me. I'm not for this. Basically, what I felt like was anyone that tells you in any art form that there's only one way to do something is telling you basically, this is how I did this thing, and that's all they're telling you, you know? Because there are writers who just write once a week.
Mm.
There's writers that just write once a month, and they're writers. But in this case, the person is trying to say, if you want to be a professional writer in the comic book industry, you've got to write every day. And I just want to say, like, as someone who has worked professionally in the comic book industry since about 1999, I don't work every day. You know, maybe there is a little bit of me that writes every day in that if I get an idea, I will write it down. But I don't think that's the case at all. And the idea that, you know, miss sleep, don't go to obligations, ignore your family, you know, just bear it's something that feels, you know. I think it's something that writers like to feel about themselves. It's just like, look at me, I'm suffering for my craft, and it feels like something, but it feels to me like I'm also an actor. And it feels like those kind of acting classes where you just tear yourself apart and, you know, now turn to the person on your right and tell them something you've never told anybody in your life, a deep secret. Okay, now you're really acting. And it's like, yeah, that could be acting, or just make it up and pretend to be a thing. That's also an option. There's always a second way of doing things.
Well, I like what you said about it, which was that, it, you know, you set up this extreme rule, and now if people don't follow it, they feel like they're failing as a creator. And you can say that about Dave Sims, do a page a day rule, which is impossible for a regular person
right.
to follow, especially if you're just starting out in comics.
Yeah.
you know.
I mean, I was thinking, I was talking to someone about, you know, the idea of doing a 5-issue limited series of a comic, which basically comes down to about maybe about 100 pages. And that sounds like a lot. That sounds very imposing. And it is really imposing.
Yeah.
But if you think, you know, in the course of a year, that means you've got to draw one page every 3 days, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and even that, like, not really. You know, you still can take a day or two off, and you'll come up with 5 issues of a comic by the end of the year.
That's pretty good.
That's not, you know, a heartbreak. Yeah. But if you get someone to go, you got to do a page a day, and it's every day, and the same thing with the writing. And I've heard this as a writer. You got to sit down in the morning and write for 3 hours. Solid, man.
Yeah.
You got to just put it out there, man, every day, or you're not a... No, that's not true. Again, anything in any art form where someone tells you the path that you must take, that's nonsense.
The second rule was finish what you write.
Right, and something... And I agree that you do have to finish things, because if you don't finish things... And it's the easy thing to do is not to finish things, because if you don't finish things, no one will ever judge the thing. It will just remain on your computer or in your file cabinet or in your desk or what have you. But his thing was, you got to finish everything. You don't have to finish everything. You can prioritize and go, I've got to finish this. And you can leave some stuff unfinished. That's fine. Again, it was an extreme that I didn't think was, you know, necessary. you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get it. You got to finish some stuff. There's a bit. Oh, by the way, here comes the siren.
I think it's going in a different direction.
And the siren went in a different direction, much like many projects that I was hired to do ended up going in a different direction, which is a way of saying you're fired. Get used to, by the way, projects going in a different direction.
Different direction. So that's rule number 3. Believe in yourself and don't fear failure.
Yeah, fuck that. You can fear failure all you want. Like, this is, again, something that bothers me. Where someone goes, here's how you got to feel. No, you don't. You can fear failure.
Sure.
What you got to do, though, is still do it.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise the thing won't get done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if a guy is terrified or if the guy is confident when he does the thing. The thing is, you got to do the thing.
Sure.
And when you've done the thing, you've done the thing.
Sure.
And, you know, it would be nice if you weren't terrified.
Yeah.
Probably healthier for you. You know, easier on the system. I've been through a lot of stress myself in my life. I've had my hair fall out. I've got psoriasis from stress right now. Probably it would be nice to not be stressed. But, you know, you do the thing anyway. And I think that is one thing that differentiates people who do things from people who don't, is the one difference is you can tell the person who does things because they've done the thing.
There you go.
Yeah.
You start with one, and before you know it, you're at 223.
Yeah, that is something. And what was the fourth one of the list?
Fourth one was the 10 cons, which I don't think is, you know, for...
That's to me what really, really felt like, okay, and I know the person who's writing this, and they're very social, and they've got a charming accent, and they're very good with a glass in their hand, and they're very good with playing a room, and that's great. And if you're that guy, fantastic. Mm-hmm. And you do have to do a certain amount of, you know, meeting people at some point for things to happen.
Sure.
But I think in this day and age... If you've got a good, strong web presence and you're putting stuff out there that's quality and put it out on a repeated basis, and you're like, say, a Kate Beaton, you're going to get noticed at some point, and people are going to want to publish you. And that's the way that's going to go. And you don't have to go and like schmooze at cons as much as you had to in the old days when there was no other way to see your work except you bringing it to people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I really... Shoot. Sorry. Okay. That was me knocking over a glass of water, everybody. Because I'm a gesture talker,
right.
But sorry about that. It's empty now. My glass is empty.
It is.
Shoot. Now I have to stop the show because I can't talk.
That's okay. We also got a couple of people waiting for us at a restaurant in about 10 minutes.
Okay. So let me just say one last thing then before we...
Please. Which means 3 things.
It's true enough. I appreciate the fact that you do that, that you take time to disarm what I think are creative bombs that people throw in other people's paths. You know, it's when you hear those sort of things from people you admire or people that you doing what you want to do, you know, you can think that way. You can think, well, this is how everyone's done it. Everyone who writes, I don't care who they are. I don't care if it's Charles Dickens. I don't care if it was Dashiell Hammett. I don't care if it's some other guy. Dashiell Dickens, Ian Boothby. They write every single day.
Sure. Yeah,
and are always at it, always writing,
right.
Or never hunched not over. Writing.
Hunched over,
scribble,
tap, 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 tap,
covered in ink.
That's right.
For
Papa, get out! Your Trumbo in the bath, telling your daughter who's having a birthday, No, no knocking on the door while I'm in here. Sure. I'm a writer.
And the fact is that a lot of writing is thinking.
Yeah.
You know, and you need to have that time to generate ideas, to generate, you know, the momentum or whatever in your story to get from A to B, to B to C, to carry on with your story.
The horse has to go in the stable for a while and it relax and have some hay
it is
and
very
take
true.
A nap.
Yeah.
And if you don't let the horse do that, you're going to have a dead horse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean,
that's your brain and your soul.
Sure. And we've used this show in a way to trick me to be creative. You know, that as someone who was taught very early on that what I do is not good enough. And that's, you know, all my parents as people who just were perfectionists. Mm-hmm. And could not allow a child to do a chore in the house without
coming
in.
Which is why they ended up with three perfect children.
Without sweeping in to fix it, you know, after you vacuumed.
Yeah.
After I vacuumed, my mom would vacuum. After I swept, my dad would come in and take what I was doing and
I don't want to say what they did on your honeymoon. There we go.
On that note, everybody, let's call it... Let's call it a truce.
You're not doing it right.
Let's call it a truce.
Get out of here.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to our crazy show. We're just kind of wild here.
Yeah. We're wacky.
We don't know what's going to happen.
I know.
It's usually nothing.
Buckle up, because
it's going to be a
we might crash and burn in a car accident because it's tragic. Or we might drive into the water and drown
like
those kids did.
You don't know.
We're dedicating this show to those kids who burned and drowned at the same time.
At the same time. It was in the water. It was weird.
Yeah, the flaming water.
Flaming water.
Of Flint, Michigan.
It's a strange thing.
By the way, say no to fracking, everybody. So those kind of accidents don't happen again.
Mm. Is that a real thing?
No. What a horrible thing it would be. Hey, folks.
You kind of
give our information.
If you want to be wacky, come and join us on our website, sneakydragon.com. That's where our message board is. You can write there. The last episode actually had a lot of comments, and I appreciate everyone's comments. I don't always respond, but I always chuckle.
Mm-hmm. You got to respond every day. It's how you maintain a web presence.
That's true.
Get right. online every day and promote the show.
You're right.
Oh. Always be closing.
Yep.
That's how the pros do it. You think Mark Maron's not on every damn day?
Well, his assistant.
Talking about his cats.
His unpaid intern is.
Okay.
Yes, you can join us on the board. You can reach us by email at sneakyd@sneakydragon.com. We always appreciate emails. You can go to the Facebook page and find us at Sneaky Dragon. You can go to Twitter and find us at sneaky_dragon. You can find our Tumblr page, Sneaky Dragon, which is basically just a repeat of what's on the website. But frankly, the Tumblr seems to be something that's happening.
Yeah, that's if you're young, go to Tumblr.
If you're young, go to Tumblr. If you're old, go to the website. If you are in between, go to Facebook.
Right.
And
Tumblr has more dirty pictures than all those other options.
I'm sure you know this, but we are on iTunes.
Yep.
And we are now
Stitcher.
Stitcher. And we are now going to be on Google Play.
Woo!
We were just accepted. We were accepted to Google Play because I guess they're going to bring in a free podcast app as well. So that's a good thing because I had to pay for a podcast app for my Android and now I don't have to.
Excellent.
Although it is a good app. But anyway. All right, guys. Thank you for listening to our show. We appreciate it. And we will see you again next week.
Bye.